From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In many cases, we don't know where all journalists are on the battlefield. We certainly know where the embedded journalists are at any given time that are operating with our formations. And that was a conscious decision to take in embedded journalists.
A U.S. tank fires on the Palestine Hotel, where most of the unembedded foreign journalists are staying in Baghdad, killing a Reuters cameraman, severely injuring another of the Reuters staff, and as well as hurting three other Reuters reporters. The military, U.S. military, also bombs the offices of Al Jazeera and Abu Dhabi TV, killing an Al Jazeera reporter. We'll look at the career of General Jay Garner, who's set to be put in charge by the Bush administration to govern Iraq after the invasion. And we go to Northern Ireland, where over 1,000 protesters greeted the Bush-Blair summit. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The battle for Baghdad is raging. Plumes of smoke are billowing from the city as tanks, artillery, and planes attack government ministries and official buildings, as well as residential areas. A U.S. tank fired on the Palestine Hotel today, killing Reuters cameraman Taras Prostyuk. The building is where most of the foreign journalists in Baghdad are based. Three other Reuters staff and a Spanish cameraman were also wounded. U.S. troops claim snipers were shooting at them from the building. Reporters deny this. A U.S. bombing raid also hit Al Jazeera's Baghdad office. Al Jazeera reporter Tariq Ayub has died from injuries sustained in the attack, and an Al Jazeera cameraman is in the hospital. The office of another Arabic news network, Abu Dhabi TV, was also hit. The BBC reports the station has lost contact with its reporter. Iraqi state television went off the air in Baghdad today. U.S. military officials indicated they'd targeted television transmitters. Two European reporters were killed when an Iraqi rocket destroyed the 2nd Brigade's tactical operations center on the southern outskirts of Baghdad. That strike also killed two U.S. soldiers and destroyed some 17 U.S. military vehicles. Iraqi street units have killed at least four other U.S. soldiers in the capital. Unknown hundreds of Iraqis have died. A B-1 bomber dropped four 2,000-pound bunker-busting bombs on a building in a residential neighborhood today. U.S. officials say they had received a tip that Saddam Hussein and his sons might be meeting there. A U.S. official told the Washington Post the Bush administration is, quote, moderately hopeful that Saddam Hussein was there. At least three buildings were destroyed in the attack on the district of Al-Mansur in western Baghdad. The London Guardian is reporting residents standing around the rubble said shrapnel killed victims as far as 200 meters away. Iraqi forces staged a major counterattack this morning, sending buses and trucks full of fighters over the Tigris River in an attempt to overrun U.S. forces holding a strategic intersection on the western side of Baghdad. The Associated Press reports the Iraqis briefly retook the intersection, but U.S. forces soon regained it. A U.S. commander said at least 50 Iraqi fighters were killed. Iraqis also staged a counterattack on Saddam Hussein presidential palace, but the U.S. says they were repulsed. At another intersection, the Washington Post reports Iraqis fired on a U.S. ammunition truck, which exploded, set fire to a new nearby fuel tank truck and two special forces trucks. At least two U.S. soldiers were killed. Two others were wounded by friendly fire before U.S. soldiers killed the Iraqis or forced their surrender. A U.S. A-10 Warthog plane went down near Baghdad airport today. Central Command said the pilot was rescued and would not say whether the plane was shot down. Iraqi Information Minister Mohammed al-Sahaf told reporters today, quote, "We are going to tackle them and going to destroy them. They are going to surrender or be burned in their tanks." Civilians are dying by the hundreds. Systematic reports and civilian casualties are not available. At least 14 civilians were killed when a bomb crashed into a residential neighborhood in central Baghdad yesterday, witnesses told the Agence France-Presse. They said the explosion destroyed four houses off a main commercial artery in the Al-Mansour area. Nine members of a family, including two children and five other people, were found dead. Neighbors and relief workers were searching through the rubble of the collapsed buildings for other victims. London Independent correspondent Robert Fisk reports on his visit to a Baghdad hospital. He saw a two-year-old boy lying in agony on the bed, his clothes soaked with blood, a tube through his nose. A middle-aged female civil servant with her face, breasts, thighs, arms, and feet pop-marked with shrapnel from a U.S. cluster bomb. A car salesman who just lost his eye but whose feet were still dripping blood. Fisk writes, quote, "It looks very neat on television. The American Marines on the banks of the Tigris. The oh-so-funny visit to the presidential palace. The videotape of Saddam Hussein's golden loom. But the innocent are bleeding and screaming with pain to bring us our exciting television pictures and to provide Messrs. Bush and Blair with their boastful talk of victory." A relative of the two-year-old walked up to Fisk in the hospital, his voice rising in fury. He shouted, "I want to talk to you. Why do you British want to kill this little boy? Why do you even want to look at him? You did this. You did it." Reuters correspondent Hassan Hafid reports meeting 18-year-old Sarur Yas. She and her family were trying to flee the city yesterday in their minibus when she heard a warplane overhead. She begged her father to turn around, but he wouldn't listen. Then explosions rocked the bus, and her father, mother, three sisters, three brothers, and a sister-in-law were killed. Another Reuters correspondent, Kieran Murray, reports on an incident in Karbala when a young Iraqi boy stooped to pick up a rocket-propelled grenade off the body of a dead paramilitary. U.S. Army Private Nick Boggs unloaded machine gun fire, and the boy fell dead on a garbage-strewn stretch of wasteland. Peter Arnett reports for the London Mirror from the Baghdad suburb of Al-Salan. There, he met a baker holding a blackened flatbread in his outstretched arms. Behind him are the smoldering remains of his bakery. A few feet away, under sheets of blood-stained newspaper on the pavement, are the remains of his 12-year-old son, Abu. Arnett reports there are no obvious military targets there, just row after row of mud-walled houses. Reuters reports hospital sources say thousands of people had been killed and wounded since the United States and Britain started their invasion. Baghdad hospitals are overwhelmed. Surgeons are working nonstop and running short of anesthetics and equipment. Fresh water is short. The Red Cross delivered thousands of one-liter water bags to the main hospitals in Baghdad before the U.S. attack began, but stocks are now running low. Water shortages are also acute in Karbala, Najaf, Nasiriyah, and Basra. The U.S. Army is claiming preliminary tests on substances found at a military training camp near Karbala indicate the presence of the deadly nerve agents sarin and talbin. But Reuters reports that military officials say the metal drums there don't contain chemical weapons agents. Earlier, a chemical testing team made up of biologists and chemists disproved a previous claim of sarin traces at a facility near Baghdad. A dozen soldiers guarding the compound became sick and nauseated, but preliminary field results indicate the substance at the site was pesticide, not sarin. There are conflicting reports on the fate of Ali Hassan Majid. Majid is being called Chemical Ali by the U.S. and British forces for ordering the use of poison gas against ethnic Kurds 15 years ago. U.S. forces over the weekend bombed a compound in Basra where they believed Majid was staying. Yesterday morning, British officers said they found Majid's body, but by the evening, British forces said they believe Majid might have survived the attack. Donald Rumsfeld said he believes Majid is dead. More than 1,000 people protested near Hillsborough Castle in Belfast, where President Bush met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Bush and Blair met to discuss the post-war occupation and government of Iraq. The U.S. military found suspicious substances in corroding metal drums at a military training camp near the city of Karbala. U.S. Army says preliminary tests indicate a high probability of the presence of nerve agents, but Reuters quotes U.S. military sources saying the tests indicate it's not chemical weapons, but pesticide. Police fired concussion grenades, sting grenades, wooden dowels, and beanbags at anti-war protesters blocking the port of Oakland, California yesterday. Six longshoremen caught in the line of fire were treated for injuries. Demonstrators targeted the port because companies there are shipping war supplies. As civilians continue to die in Iraq, the U.S. has condemned the massacre of 1,000 civilians in the Democratic Republic of Congo and urged the country's warring parties to end hostilities. The executions are said to have taken place last Thursday, one day after a multi-party peace accord to end the broader Congolese conflict was signed in South Africa. U.N. investigators confirmed the massacre on Monday. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 yesterday. The government can ban cross burning when it is used to intimidate or terrorize people. However, the court did not outlaw cross burning across the board. Writing for the majority, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said doing so would, quote, create an unacceptable risk of the suppression of ideas. The ruling leaves open the possibility of cross burning at Klan rallies as an expression of political sympathy with an ideology. The Cuban government began handing out harsh prison sentences to dozens of dissidents accused of subversion and collaborating with U.S. diplomats against the Castro regime. The longest sentence was handed out to Omar Rodriguez Saludis, an independent reporter who covered the news in Havana. Poet and journalist Raul Rivero's 20-year sentence is likely a death sentence. The veteran dissident suffers from phlebitis and other illnesses. Nearly 80 people have been arrested in an island-wide sweep that began the night the U.S. began invading Iraq. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the number of people in prison and jail has topped 2 million. This, the Justice Department says, for the first time. The country's prison population has doubled since 1990. One out of every 143 U.S. citizens are behind bars. The proportion is far greater for African Americans. The U.S. has the largest prison population in the world. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, recently returned from Baghdad. Well, the casualties just keep mounting, Jeremy, as the battle for Baghdad rages on. Among those who have been killed, Al Jazeera reporter, who is at his offices, an Al Jazeera cameraman, has been injured. Abu Dhabi TV has been bombed by U.S. forces, and the Palestine Hotel attacked by U.S. forces, where almost all of the unembedded reporters stay in Baghdad.
It is very well known that all of the international press corps, almost all of the international press corps, with the exception of Abu Dhabi, Jazeera, and a handful of others, are staying at the Palestine Hotel. Remember why the Iraqi government said that it expelled CNN. Because CNN had created an exodus from the Al Rashid Hotel, which is on the western side of Baghdad, which is in the heart of government power, because CNN was telling other journalists that they had information that the U.S. planned to bomb the Al Rashid Hotel. And so CNN moved over to the Palestine Hotel. This was prior to the beginning of the attacks. And they said they did so because of reports that the Pentagon was going to hit the Al Rashid. And so all international journalists, because CNN had gone to that hotel, went and stayed in the Palestine Hotel. That was where Peter Arnett was reporting from on NBC. That was where Laura Logan from CBS was reporting. It is very well known to the Pentagon and to the White House that the entire international press corps is staying at the Palestine Hotel.
At CENTCOM, the press briefing, the questions asked of the U.S. military, are you targeting reporters? And they say they can't account for where unembedded reporters are.
Well, I mean, that just on the surface is completely outrageous. And journalists have rights under international law to be protected from warring factions or from an attack such as this. What's interesting is that just yesterday, Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf, the Iraqi information minister, for the first time held his press conference on the roof of the Palestine Hotel. And secondly, with the bombing of Al Jazeera and Abu Dhabi TV that we now know has happened, those houses of Abu Dhabi and Al Jazeera TV are on the banks of the Tigris River, and they're in a stretch, a long stretch of a residential area. They are near to the Ministry of Information, but they are also in a very crowded residential strip that is along the Tigris River. And they're always getting exclusives with Iraqi government officials.
Well, we're going to turn to the issue now of the U.S. high command moving in to Iraq. President, viceroy, governor, sheriff. It's difficult to know what to call Jay Garner, the retired U.S. general who will run Iraq if and when Saddam Hussein is deposed. The Call Me Jay 64-year-old would prefer coordinator of civilian administration. That's the bland description of his job heading the Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, the Pentagon agency preparing to govern Iraq's 23 million people in the aftermath of war, provide humanitarian support, and administer the lucrative business of reconstruction. That's the opening lines of a recent piece titled in part Man Who Would Be King of Iraq that appeared in the London Observer. We're joined by the author of that piece, Oliver Morgan from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you lay out for us just who Jay Garner is?
Well, Jay Garner is a former general in the United States Army. He actually has a track record which is impressive, and I think has impressed people in humanitarian relief. He was head of Operation Provide Comfort in northern Iraq at the end of the previous Gulf War, and he won plaudits for his work there. Indeed, when he left, the people who he was there to protect made it clear they didn't want him to leave, but he did. When he got back, he carried on in the U.S. Army. He joined the missile and the Space and Missile Defense Command later in the decade, and became very involved in thinking around the issues of defending the U.S. using military using missile systems. But eventually left the army in 1997, and then went into the private sector, where he joined a company called SY Technology, which is a missile systems company. It provides highly technical missile systems technology expertise to various missile programs, including the Patriot system that's being used now, and it's done so overseas for various countries, including Israel.
Relations between Garner and the United Nations?
And the United Nations. Well, what we know is that the United Nations is very uneasy about the attitude of if we can call it the hawkish element of the U.S. administration, which is generally perceived to be centered around the Pentagon, which has let it be known, certainly it seems from here, publicly that, or almost publicly, that it's, it views the U.N. role in Iraq post-war as being almost unnecessary. The U.N. therefore has natural, perhaps, suspicion of this element of the U.S. administration. And given that Garner has very close links with that part of the administration, he served on one of Donald Rumsfeld's commissions looking at defending the U.S. through missile defense. It was known as Rumsfeld II. Knowing that he has close connections to Rumsfeld, knowing also that he worked in the Operation Provide Comfort in 91 when then Secretary of Defense was Dick Cheney, now the Vice President. He is associated with this band of, shall we call them hawks, in the administration. And just from that very fact, people in at the United Nations are concerned about having someone like that, it's my understanding anyway, having someone like that involved in running Iraq after a war, given that there is so much controversy over the UN role. More specifically, it's known that Garner had a meeting with UN officials before he actually left for Kuwait, and people that were at the meeting have said, you know, that it was a frosty meeting, that the United Nations officials there, of course, were feeling concerned about the likely role that they were going to have, and that Garner was unforthcoming about the role that he was going to be executing there as well. So I think there was, I think frosty is probably the best description of it.
Oliver Morgan, if you wouldn't mind staying on the line with us for a minute, Oliver Morgan speaking to us with The Guardian and Observer newspapers. We've just made contact with Jihad Ali Balut, who is the Al Jazeera spokesperson in Qatar. He only has a moment to speak. We wanted to get the latest on the news of the U.S. bombing of the Al Jazeera offices and the killing of an Al Jazeera reporter in Baghdad in that bombing, as well as the injuring of a cameraman. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jihad Ali Balut.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what happened?
Around 7 o'clock a.m. Local time, Doha time, an airplane, American airplane, circled the area twice, and then we had two missiles go into our building, as a result of which we've lost a dear and close colleague, and we had a cameraman injured. And as far as the physical damage to property, the building, which is a two-story building, and it exclusively houses Al Jazeera, was damaged, and some equipment were damaged as well.
Can you tell us about the reporter? Can you tell us about Tariq Ayoub?
I mean, he's a young man. I think he's about 34 years of age. Jordanian of Palestinian descent. He married one child, a little girl of 1 year of age. He's been with us since 1997. His dream, interim dream, so to speak, was to cover the unfortunate conflict in Iraq. And he's been part of our operation for that long, almost ever since we've started.
I wanted to get your response to the military briefer at CENTCOM, actually where you are in Qatar, when questioned about whether reporters are being targeted. Al Jazeera bombed Abu Dhabi TV, as well as the Palestine Hotel, where a reporter was killed and other reporters seriously injured. This is Army Brigadier General Vincent Brooks, spokesperson for U.S. Central Command at regional headquarters in Doha.
In many cases, right. We don't know where all journalists are on the battlefield. We certainly know where the embedded journalists are at any given time that are operating with our formations. And that was a conscious decision to take in embedded journalists. There were some combat actions that also occurred at the Palestine Hotel. Initial reports indicate that the coalition force operating near the hotel took fire from the lobby of the hotel and returned fire.
And that was the response on whether journalists were being targeted. Jihad Ali Balut. The issue of they know where U.S. forces know where the embedded reporters are, but not the unembedded.
Well, I mean, I really don't want to comment on what the American officer had to say. But what I would say is it is really a black day for all journalism in general. When a journalist cannot go about doing his job in relative safety, at least his safety would be ensured by the flag bearer of freedom of expression in the world. And that I'm not hinting for one second Al Jazeera was intentionally targeted. I would leave this to the investigators, and I hope that the American authorities are conducting an investigation, because I think that's the least that they can do, since it was an American flight that actually hit Al Jazeera and our colleagues as well. I think a Reuters colleague lost his life as well in the pursuance of his job. We at Al Jazeera, we've always had the safety and well-being of our people uppermost in our minds, even before the actual war started. Just before, on the 24th of February, we communicated with the Ministry of Defense in the States. We actually sent them a letter indicating to them that we will be covering the war, indicating to them that we will be there, the number of people that are going to be there. We even gave them the exact location of our headquarters, which I as I said before, it's a two-story building with a roof. Nobody stays there except for us. We gave them the exact location in terms of longitude, latitude, the height of the building from the ground, the number of the house, the street, and the number of the street, the general area and the specific area. And we urged them actually to pass on this information to the field commanders, who perhaps can pass it on to relevant people. Having said that, I mean, it is the last thing that happened to Al Jazeera, the unfortunate, the tragic events of today. I think they are it's a series of unfortunate events that happened to Al Jazeera from day one, literally. I think within a few days of the outbreak of hostilities, our correspondent in the north of Iraq was apprehended by a group of Turkish militias. Kurdish, I should say, Kurdish militias. He was locked up for a few hours and then released. Only a few days ago, Al Jazeera's headquarters at the Sheraton Hotel in Basra was at the receiving end of a couple of missiles as well. Bearing in mind that Al Jazeera is the only guest at the Sheraton Hotel in Basra, and the only news team covering events unfold in that southern city of Iraq. And then only yesterday, a car clearly bearing the insignia and markings of Al Jazeera was shot as it was approaching, a American checkpoint in Baghdad, on the express highway in Baghdad. Then the guy was stopped, the driver was stopped, he was talked to a little bit, and then he was asked to return. Upon which, when he was a few meters away, he was shot at again. And our reporters in Mosul and in Basra, two reporters in Basra and one reporter in Mosul, have been threatened for their lives by Iraqi militias accompanying the American forces. And I think the last bombing really brings back to mind again the tragic bombing of our Kabul office back in towards the back end of 2001. So 2002, I should say. So basically, I mean, what else can I say?
This was when U.S. Forces.
I'm really reluctant to give any judgment on this one. I think the indications are there. We still, I mean, we have been objective all along. We are not going to lose our objectivity now. We believe that we have to wait perhaps for results of an investigation, which I hope is going on as we speak now, before we make up our minds. We have received we have sent, I think, 6 letters to the Pentagon since between 24th of February and the 7th of April, which was yesterday, to the military authorities and American military authorities at the Pentagon. I believe that a letter from the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York has sent, in the past week to 10 days, has sent a letter again advising, I think it was sent to Secretary Rumsfeld's office, advising them of Al Jazeera's concern and reiterating the location of Al Jazeera offices. But apparently all this has been in vain. Again, all I can say is it's been a really black day for journalism in general. And my heart goes out to our colleagues to start with and all our colleagues out there who really risk life and limb in the pursuit of what they believe is their duty on earth.
Well, Jihad Ali Balut, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Al Jazeera spokesperson. We have to break, and then we're going to come back to our guest on the line, reporter Oliver Morgan, reporter for The Guardian and Observer newspapers. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of vengeance in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we want with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they...
Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore. Here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill as we turn back to Oliver Morgan, reporter with The Guardian and Observer newspapers, talking about who is preparing for taking over Iraq, a major feature piece he did on Jay Garner, the retired general who is right now in Kuwait City, at a hotel heading into Iraq. You talked about Jay Garner's connections to SY Industries. Can you talk more about the Pentagon connection and the question of what this means about what aspect of the U.S. government is in control right now? What are the plans for who will be in control of Iraq?
Sure. I mean, I think it's clear that Ghana is a friend, an associate. He's worked on commissions which are chaired by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He's associated clearly with Rumsfeld, and his activities both within the army and since he's left are very much in line with that, with what you can identify as Rumsfeld's agenda, perhaps, on modernizing the U.S. Army, U.S. defense, which is high tech. It's based on missile defense. It's based on technology reaching up into space. He's very interested in the Star Wars program, in reinvigorating that, which seemed to die after the Reagan years. And so that's why Ghana found himself on this Rumsfeld II commission, which was effectively kind of extending the missile defense system into space. I think he's very clearly linked with that, and it's demonstrable. He's an advocate and a kind of evangelizer for these sorts of these sorts of approaches to defense. If you look, he was involved in deploying Patriot missiles in Israel in the first Gulf War, and we all know what a high profile they played in the reporting of the war, perhaps in the propaganda element of the war, when they were seen to be defending Tel Aviv and so on. After the war, it emerged that perhaps they weren't as effective as had been reported, and it was Jay Garner who, in Congress, stood up and defended their record, saying that they had a good record in defending Israeli cities and in Saudi cities too. He defended their record in Congress. He then went through, as I said before, the Space and Missile Defense Command, where he was charged with and delivered, raising the whole issue of Star Wars back up the defense agenda. And then when he left the services, the forces in 1997, he goes to SY Technology. And lo and behold, it's a company that specializes in missile systems, and it emerges, it provides that expertise directly into the Patriot system that Garner himself worked on the deployment of in Israel and defended in Congress, so resolutely. So that's his kind of, I think, the links are both personal with Rumsfeld and with the personalities around him, but also they're very ideological as well. He does believe, he is a believer in these, in the same sorts of, the same sort of approach to defense and the same sorts of techniques, technologies that need to be invested in to do that.
Also, as you point out in your article, he traveled to Israel with JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and signed on to a statement in the year 2000 that said that, quote, Israel had exercised remarkable restraint in the face of lethal violence orchestrated by the leadership of a Palestinian authority.
Absolutely. I think if you're sitting in Iraq watching Baghdad being bombed as it has been bombed, watching American armored columns driving through the countryside, and you're questioning the motives, and you're questioning why this has to happen to your homeland, to your country, which, as a British commander I think said before the British troops went into Basra, is the cradle of civilization. It's the ancient Mesopotamia and so on. In other words, if you are an Arab with a very with a clear and proud view of your history, it would at least cause you to question, perhaps, the thinking that America has on governing that country by putting in place someone who has signed such a declaration, who's visited Israel on so many occasions, and who has put on the public record such views about the Palestinians.
Oliver Morgan, you also write about Andrew Natsios, the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, who you said set out to counter accusations that $600 million worth of contracts for reconstruction Iraq that he is to award to U.S. companies, some with strong Republican links, were examples of cronyism. And you quote him saying, if you need a surgeon, a lawn service, a real estate agent, or a college, you seek out the names with the reputation for quality and the ability to get the job done. Strange, then, you write, that his front runner is construction giant Bechtel, based in San Francisco, whose record is managing America's biggest public works project, which record, by most accounts, has been disastrous. And you go on to talk about the big dig in Boston. Can you talk about Andrew Natsios, head of USAID, and his connections to it?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not saying anything directly which sort of accuses him of any impropriety, because I'm sure that that's not the case. What I think is odd, though, however, is that he would make such a statement saying, you do seek out the best person for the job. Of course, much of what's happening in Iraq is going to require, reconstruction on a mammoth scale. And, when you look at public works in the U.S. on a mammoth scale, the big dig is perhaps the biggest, and it's gone wrong in a big way. And Bechtel, along with a co-contractor, is right at the center of it. So it just seemed odd to me that he would be saying, talking about the need for quality and expertise and so on, when he has such intimate knowledge of that, because he was the head of the Turnpike Authority in Massachusetts. And before that, the head of that state's budget office, effectively. So he has, closer knowledge than most, if I can put it that way, of what has been, I think, generally accepted as a disastrous, perhaps the most disastrous, large public works scheme in the U.S., and that involves Bechtel. But I think the bigger point is that, and I think this is something that certainly from the U.K., obviously based here and not in the U.S., the criticism of the way in which the contracting side of reconstruction, the way in which USAID has put out a series of contracts for tender, and then on the biggest one has involved five companies, two of which are known to have very strong Republican links, has caused people to ask to ask questions and to wonder what this is all about. Halliburton, as everybody knows, the chief executive there was Dick Cheney for the latter part of the 1990s before he rejoined the Bush administration. Bechtel has had links with the Republican Party going back decades, going back to the Reagan years. And then you can look at the other companies involved and find, if not senior Republicans, certainly people who have been involved in agencies such as the CIA at a very senior level for a number of years. So, in terms of Bechtel and Halliburton, there are concerns about Republican links. For the world at large, however, one looks at the whole process and sees five companies being put onto a shortlist, five companies of which know how to play the Washington game, if you like. That leads on to another point, which, if I'm not going on too long, that leads on to another point, which is that, people do see, certainly from this side of the Atlantic, do see that there is a very strong link between business and the political process. It's a link that sometimes, I suppose, causes people to throw their hands up and say, how can people be so brazen about it? On the other hand, however, and paradoxically, it's a great matter of respect and admiration for the United States that it is possible actually to see what's going on, because it's all documented and it's all recorded in the open.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Oliver Morgan, who is reporter with The Guardian and Observer newspapers in Britain. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we break and return to talk about the Blair-Bush summit in Northern Ireland. Stay with us.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your Holy Empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Is it for freedom or our comfort and convenience? Is it to profit for big business we pledge our allegiance?
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Sarah Thompson. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. As we go now to Northern Ireland, where President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have been meeting outside Belfast to discuss the administration of post-war Iraq and the role of the United Nations. Blair said earlier today the UN would have a, quote, vital role in the effort to repair Iraq's infrastructure, but said ultimately the country must be run by the Iraqi people. Although the former U.S. General Jay Garner is set to be put in place to head up Iraq, President Bush gave the impression the interim authority would be made up of Iraqis from inside and outside the country. Outside the summit, more than 1,000 anti-war demonstrators protested near Hillsborough Castle, south of Belfast, where the talks were being held. The demonstrators came from all over Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic, converging on Hillsborough in a procession of cars and chartered buses over 2 miles long. We're joined right now by two people to talk about the significance of the summit. We're joined by Davy Carlin, representative from the Northern Ireland Public Service Alliance, the largest trade union in Northern Ireland, with the Stop the War coalition there. And by Mairead Corrigan Maguire, Nobel Peace Prize winner, who's not in Northern Ireland right now, though she won the Nobel Peace Prize for her work there. She's been on a liquid fast since the invasion of Iraq began, in front of the White House, where she holds a silent vigil every day from noon until 2. Davy Carlin, can you talk about the summit that has just taken place?
Well, first of all, just like listeners to know, what's taking place presently at this minute is armed RUC personnel in full riot gear have now moved against school children and young peace activists on Belfast City Street, and this operation is still ongoing. Last night, the demonstrations up at Hillsborough were about several thousand strong. They brought activists from all over Ireland to the demonstrations. A wide layer of different trade union groups, peace activists, student groups marched upon Hillsborough to make their voices known for two reasons. Firstly, that George W. Bush is coming here and amongst the peace process to lecture people in this small part of the world on peace while he's at war butchering others around in Iraq. And secondly, he came here because he believed that he wouldn't see such mass demonstrations as you would see elsewhere around Europe. But there were still significant numbers of people marched, and again, full riot police came against us again. But I think it's despicable that the riot police are now presently getting into young school children on the streets of Belfast who are peacefully protesting against George W. Bush's visit here.
Mairead Maguire, the two leaders spoke about the significance of meeting in Belfast, almost talking about as a model for how people can cooperate when looking at Iraq. Your response?
Well, the peace process in Northern Ireland, which both Bush and Blair are encouraging us to do, is a process whereby we are trying to institute proper human rights, proper civil liberties, proper equality laws, where we're trying to make our police both accountable and transparent in all their actions, where we're trying to build genuine democracy. And it's quite ironic that President Bush is there in Belfast supporting us in these things. And here in America, his administration is removing the civil liberties and human rights of the American people. Also, President Bush and Blair are encouraging us and have down through the years to solve our problems through nonviolence, through the ways of peace. And it's ironic that both Bush and Blair have, against the wishes of the international community, taken the world to war. I think what has to happen now is the international community, through the United Nations and the European Parliament, have to take steps to hold Bush and Blair accountable for these crimes against humanity, which are now happening in Iraq against our Iraqi brothers and sisters. And we must put down a marker now that this is a war against humanity, and it was carried out against the wishes of the vast majority of the human family. Northern Ireland had huge numbers out both before and after the war saying no to this war, lift the sanctions. They're only a model of what's happening around the world. The world didn't want this war, and the world is looking into America and saying, what are you doing taking the world to war when we need the money that's in your militarism to try and solve the problems of housing, education? Wherever we live, people are needing this money and not the madness of taking the world to war. So we must put down a marker, because I'm hearing talk here about, is Syria next? Is Iran next? Is North Korea next? If the world community doesn't stand up and say this war was immoral, it was illegal, it was against our wishes, and hold internationally accountable those men who had the audacity to take us to war, then I'm afraid there will be another war, and who's next? So we, the people, have to unite, we have to mobilize, and we have to help the American peace activists who are courageously breaking the law here and going to prison in their hundreds. That takes courage. But the mainstream media is not reporting the tremendous feeling here amongst many people that they don't and did not want this war.
Mairead McGuire, what about the symbolism of Blair and Bush meeting in the north of Ireland?
I think that it is tragic in one way that Bush and Blair are meeting in the north of Ireland when they have taken the world to war against our wishes. In another way, maybe if we all work and pray hard enough, these two world leaders will learn that Northern Ireland couldn't solve its problems through militarism. I mean, we had the British government, British military on our streets for years, and they couldn't solve the problem. It can't be done through paramilitarism or through violence. And initially we had to say, look, the only way to solve these deep, deep problems of ethnic conflict or wherever they are is through all-inclusive dialogue and people sitting down to listen to each other and to find a way through. It's the only way. Now, if President Bush and Mr. Blair learn that lesson in Northern Ireland, then maybe, hopefully, they will begin to sit down and negotiate a way out of the Iraqi crisis, and most certainly not agree to go to Syria or any other country with military machines where the vast majority of civilians now die in these wars.
Davy Carlin, you're there on the ground right now. What has the scale of the protests been against this meeting?
I think that the activists and the peace activists got together over a period of 2 days, and they mobilized several thousand people. In previous weeks, there's been 20,000 people marched on February the 15th and walked out, some school students, etc. So there is a fair bit of mobilization actually going on. But I'd like to touch on something that Maria has actually said about the issue of the media. Very few of the protests that are actually happening around America are actually getting back to us here. And I presume that very few of the protests that is actually happening here are actually going across to America. And I think it's important as well to understand the propaganda war, which is developing here. Just today, one of the leading newspapers here, the Belfast Telegraph, actually says, in relation to last night's demonstration, that there was a huge peace cordon to keep away enemies and anti-war protesters away from a little village. So they're putting the anti-war protesters into the same bracket as enemies of the state. And I think that's one of the reasons why these school children are being attacked now by police in red gear. I think that it's absolutely despicable. But nevertheless, many, many people have still taken to the streets. Another thing developing at the minute is that they're trying to use sectarianism on this issue as well. The unionist parties have come out and condemned the anti-war activists, where many of the nationalist parties have come out and actually marched with the anti-war activists. So they're trying to use a sectarian form of politic, even in relation to an international issue, which we're trying to cut down. And I think yesterday was reflected when you've seen both Catholic and Protestants marching upon Hillsborough Castle against this here war here. But yes, there is mobilisation. George W. Bush came here because he didn't believe there'd be much protest, but there has been thousands on the streets. And again, I have to repeat, even now, young school children are being moved against by police in red gear, which is despicable.
Davy Carlin, if you could comment on Prime Minister Blair's opening comment today when he held his news conference with President Bush in Belfast at Hillsborough Castle, saying America has long been a friend of Northern Ireland and a friend to us in this important period for the peace process. So it's both significant and welcome that the president is here in person to give once more his support. It's also perhaps fitting that here in Northern Ireland, good part of our discussion focused on the Middle East. It's not so many years ago it would have been said the peace process here was in far worse shape than the process out in the Middle East. And the comparison of what's going on in Northern Ireland with what's happening in the Middle East. And I might comment that today is the anniversary of the Israeli military moving in to Jenin and killing, well, upwards of 100 Palestinians.
Yeah, I agree with him. Also a member of the Ireland Palestine Solidarity Committee and a supporter of the International Solidarity Movement. And I think that down the parallels of our peace process is one of the reasons why the opportunist Bush has come to Northern Ireland, because he wants to come here saying that he's involved in a process of peace, while at the same time saying we can bring peace to Iraq, impose peace in Iraq, and their peace plan for the Middle East. So I think he's taken the opportunity to come here and to use that there for his own selfish interest. In relation to Tony Blair stating that America has been a friend of Ireland for a long time, and that is true, America has. American people have been a friend of Irish people for a long, long time. But even in the last couple of days, many of the nicest politicians have come out and said that it was wrong for George W. Bush to come here. Gerry Adams has said it, Mark Durcan has said it, the Women's Coalition has said it, the Alliance Party have actually said that they didn't believe it was the right time for them to come here. But nevertheless, they're actually going to meet him in Hillsborough. And this has caused a huge deal of controversy here within Belfast. The SDLP spoke at the platform yesterday, as did the Women's Coalition, as did Mitchell McLachlan, the chairman of Sinn Féin, and they were booed and heckled from the activists on the ground there.
Davy Carlin, I'm going to have to cut you off because it's the end of the show. From Northern Ireland Public Service Alliance, largest trade union, Northern Ireland, May Reid McGuire, Nobel Peace Prize winner, on a fast outside the White House in Washington. Thanks both for joining us. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Noah Rybel, and Sharif. Thank you very much. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.